When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Today I'm going to be covering the case of Joan Robinson Hill. Her unexplained death at the age of 38 led to a very strange set of events, including the rare charge of murder by omission. This is one of those cases that's technically considered to be solved, but is also not officially solved, as the main suspect was also murdered, and the main suspect in that murder was also murdered. For this video, I mostly used the book Blood and Money, the classic true story of murder, passion and power by Thomas Thompson as a source, which talks about this case in extraordinary detail. It had me hooked, and I would highly recommend. It's really detailed, it really brings you into the scene, and it's written in a way that makes you forget it's true crime. It's a really good book, so if you want a really deep dive into this case, I would highly recommend. But get ready for what I'm sure is going to be a very long video. Joan was born on February 6, 1931, scandalously to an unmarried mother, and she was swiftly given up for adoption to the Edna Gladney Home, which is now the Gladney Centre for Adoption in Fort Worth in Texas. Davis Ashton Robinson, who is most often known as Ash, was a wealthy Houston oil man, apparently the very stereotypical type with the cowboy hat and everything. He met and soon married Rhea Gardner in July 1919. Both of them were from these revered families, big names in Texas, but by the time of their marriage, neither of them had a penny to their names. All they had was their names. But Ash slowly worked his way back into wealth, getting involved in the oil business. So by 1941, the Robinsons were millionaires once again. But they couldn't have children. Rhea wasn't concerned, but Ash desperately wanted a baby girl more than anything in the world. After all their failed attempts to conceive, Ash proposed the idea of adoption. He'd heard of the Edna Gladney Home and thought that that could be their answer. And this was back in the 30s, in a time when adoption wasn't as revered as it is nowadays. It was something to be handled discreetly behind the scenes. It was a point of shame for Rhea that she couldn't give Ash a child, but Rhea did decide to travel to Fort Worth and take a look at the children at the home anyway. Blood and Money writes how Rhea recalled that she went there and didn't feel drawn to any of the crying babies. She left empty-handed and wondered how she was going to tell Ash that she just wasn't interested. But then they called the very next morning and said that they had this baby girl that they didn't bring out the night before because she had a cold, so Rhea agreed to go back. The baby girl was Joan, and Rhea fell in love. She took Joan home to be showered in love, money and affection for the rest of her childhood. Joan would later find out she was adopted when she was a teenager. And she was a daddy's girl from the moment Ash met her and Rhea at the train station. From that day, Ash would cater to Joan's every single whim. He would take her off for days at a time to oil sites and would never let her out of his sight. She was given the best of everything. And then one day, when she was just 3 years old, she had a day that would define the rest of her life. They were driving past an amusement park that was offering pony rides, and Joan told her dad that she wanted to ride those ponies. So of course they stopped. Ash paid a nickel and stuck Joan on one of the ponies' backs, and she loved it. She was a natural rider from that very first moment. And from that moment on, her entire life became about horse riding. She would return to that amusement park every single day for 6 weeks until it became clear that Joan needed a pony of her own. Ash bought one of the ponies directly off the amusement manager, and from there on, the only way was up for Joan and her first pony, Dottie. By the age of 5, she started competing against riders up to the age of 12. She won 3rd place at her first competition, and by the time she finished high school, every inch of her bedroom was covered with 1st place rosettes. Then she goes off to college, Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri, and in a very, very weird move, her dad decides to lease a suite at the hotel next to campus and moves Rhea in there. This couple were very attached to their daughter, neither of them quite knew how to exist without her. And as much as her parents doted on Joan, it seems like she was kind of suffocated under this love. She had to check with them for everything she did, and they pretty much controlled her life. But Joan also brought her horse with her to college. It was one of the reasons why she chose Stevens, because she could board her horse there. She was said to be one of the busiest girls on campus, rushing to the stables after each day. She was a very popular, achieving student who made average grades, but she wasn't very worried about her grades at all though, it was all about the horses. And eventually, she also started to notice boys. She dated a man called Spike Benton, who actually asked Ash for Joan's hand in marriage. Ash declined because Spike couldn't afford Joan's horses. But when Joan spoke to him herself, Ash couldn't say no. So Joan and Spike soon get married and they move to Florida, and Rhea and Ash soon move alongside them, Ash suddenly deciding to retire. As I'm sure the Robinsons expected, Joan and Spike split within just 6 months, at which point husband number 2 came along, Cecil Burglass. Cecil was from a good, rich family, and he did enjoy horses, so Rhea kind of accepted this union, but Ash forbid the marriage entirely. But as so often happens with strict parents and controlled children, Joan rebelled and just ended up eloping. Ash declared at this point that he was washing his hands of Joan, that she was disowned, but of course that didn't last long, she was his little girl. But eventually, Ash manipulated Joan to leave her new husband with a new Cadillac, a mink coat, a diamond ring, and any horse she wanted. So of course, she leaves Cecil and returns home to her parents, 2 marriages down at just 20 years old. It's at this point that Joan Robinson, daughter of a millionaire, begins her career, I suppose, as a socialite alongside her equestrianism. She made a name for herself around Houston and often found herself papped in the local paper. Her entire life revolved around going out each evening and spending her days at the stables where she had this strong group of friends. She was without a doubt always the queen bee. No matter what she did, Joan was always queen bee. If Joan said to do something, you would drop everything to do it. It was also around this time that Daddy bought her another mare called Beloved Belinda. Joan and Belinda would go on to do incredible things together, and this is how Joan really made her name in the equestrian world. Belinda was a really, really incredible horse. A journalist later wrote after Joan and Belinda's first ever show together, "When Joan Robinson rides Beloved Belinda, it's one of the most achingly beautiful sights in the world." For the next 7 years, the pair would get win after win, and when Joan didn't win, she would be furious and so would Ash. But together they would win 5 world championships between 1953 and 1958. It's also around this time that Joan meets a man called Dr. John Hill, introduced to her by a friend. John was born in 1931 on his parents' farm in Rio Grande Valley at the south of Texas. He was the 2nd of 3 children and was apparently always very hard to contain as a child. He was always a free spirit. John was also an incredibly talented musician, playing piano, trombone, tuba, flute, and recorder. He even got transferred to a different high school at one point that offered a better band program, but his mother wasn't happy with this. John's mother was a strict disciplinarian and had it set in her mind that John was going to be a doctor, not a musician. Although eventually in college he enrolled in a liberal arts course, he did settle on attending medical school, giving his mother her wish. John enrolled at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, where he completed a 4-year course and internship before electing for a surgery residency. In the 3rd year of said residency, he chose to specialise in plastic surgery. Now, there was a lot of money in plastic surgery, especially in a city like Houston. John was a fan of money, and luckily for him, a lot of people were a fan of John. He was a very pleasant, likeable, and talented young doctor. So, as Joan requested on the night they met, her friend set the two of them up on a date, even though they seemed to have nothing in common apart from being two beautiful, wealthy young people. They were immediately smitten with one another, with John saying that Joan was the most beautiful girl he'd ever met. And soon they wanted to marry, but there was just a small roadblock of Ash. He had to give his permission, and we all know that that hasn't gone well before. Joan's first two marriages ended awfully. But shockingly, Ash was actually okay with John. He was a man with good prospects, he was a surgeon, he was going to earn good money. He said he loved Joan and Ash agreed to the marriage. Joan was now 26 years old and she wasn't a child anymore. It was a good age to get married, which they did September 1957. For the next 6 years, the couple lived in the upstairs bedroom at Ash and Rhea's home. They wanted for nothing in those early newlywed days, but actually the couple barely saw each other. Joan was up and around the country at all of these major horse shows, and John was working all hours of the night and day at the hospital. But like I said before, they actually had nothing in common. Even if John did have spare time, he didn't want to spend it with Joan and the horses, and she wasn't interested in partaking in his favourite hobby of music. In June 1960 though, Joan gives birth to their first and only child, a son named Robert Ashton Hill. But Ash soon decides that his name was to be Boot. Boot Hill was just as spoiled by his grandfather as his mother had been before him. Which was just as well because John wasn't about to slow down with his work. In fact, John's career was only just beginning. He didn't have much time for his child. In 1963, he joined the practice of a more senior plastic surgeon called Nathan Roth, and he was constantly outperforming himself. It was said that John could do pretty much any surgery required of him with very precise skill, and women came to him from far and wide. And he alluded on occasion that the reason he married such a beautiful woman such as Joan was because people would think that her beauty was a result of his skills with the scalpel. Of course, Joan was all natural, John had never performed any surgery on her, but many people thought that he had, and John wasn't going to correct them. It was also said of John that he'd make many false promises, that he would just make as much money as he could by performing as many surgeries as a patient requested, never quite levelling with them if what they wanted was impossible, he'd just keep going in. He wanted their money and would deal with their problems later. Meanwhile, whilst John was working himself ragged, Joan was a housewife and continuing with her socialite duties. She was always at charitable commitments, galas, theatres, nightclubs, volunteering, hosting luncheons, horse shows. She was always in the papers for the latest wonderful thing that she'd done, and it was said that she was the friendliest gal in town. Men wanted her and women wanted to be her, and despite all of her money, Joan didn't care for fashion, which was fairly lucky seeing as she was now a married woman and being provided for by John. Despite John's good job and the fantastic money that he was actually earning, Joan received just $100 a month from him to run the household. Which wasn't pennies back in those days, but for a woman of Joan Robinson Hill's lifestyle and with a child to care for, it wasn't much money, and so she would often turn back to her father for monetary help. And as Joan aged, so did beloved Belinda, and so she ended up retiring her. Joan never found another horse that quite matched up to Belinda, and while she did continue riding and attending a few competitions, it was never quite as serious as it was before. She did attempt to breed from Belinda, hoping that she'd foal some very successful horses, but it turns out that Belinda just wasn't a good breeder. Joan did have this dream though, that she wanted to buy a small farm in the area so she could focus her days on breeding classic American saddlebred horses. And she also wanted this farm to be a riding school for children to get lessons that would cover the expensive cost of the breeding program. And when she brought up this idea to Ash, to her father, of course he immediately agreed to buy it for her. She said she'd already found 3 acres on the outskirts of Houston, which cost $25,000. And Joan could run it if Ash could keep the books and be in charge of the staff. And so Chatsworth Farm was born. Joan got all her friends together and set about making the place habitable. They cut the weeds, they planted flowers, they painted the rundown woods. And by 1965, this farm had 36 stables, it was impeccably clean, with a show ring and fantastic trails to explore, just 20 minutes away from the home that Joan shared with John. By this point, they'd moved out of Ash's home and were living in their own home. Now, John didn't mind Joan being busy with her new hobby because it meant that he could spend as much time as he could with his own hobby, music. Whilst John was giving Joan her $100 check each month, he was spending much, much more than that on his music. And then one day in 1965, John told Joan of a house he'd seen for sale on Kirby Drive in River Oaks, only a few houses down from Joan's parents' house on the very same block. The owners wanted to sell this house quickly and John was very anxious to own it. This was a very expensive home, but one that John thought would be fitting of his status as a surgeon. John was very much all about appearances. He thought that if he owned beautiful things, people would think much more of his skills as a surgeon, think he was successful, which is part of the reason why he loved owning Joan. She was beautiful. But of course, they couldn't actually afford this house. Ash had to loan John $12,000 for the deposit, but he was happy to do so to have his daughter and grandson just down the road from him. If the couple thought that moving into this beautiful new house would make them closer or fix any holes in their marriage, they were pretty wrong. If anything, this house pushed them further apart. It was so big that they could spend entire days together at home and barely see each other, not that they often spent days at home. Joan was almost always at Chatsworth Farm, and when John wasn't at the hospital, he was focusing on his music, playing small concerts whenever he could. As is quoted from one friend in Blood and Money, their relationship was as fragile as a piece of cooked spaghetti, but somehow they stayed together. Joan loved the man, she adored him for all of his faults, and I surmise that John wanted for some reason to stay married to her. It was also around this time that John fell out hugely with his business partner Nathan Roth and started his own practice. He was earning good money and by the end of his first year in loan practice, he'd made the equivalent of about $1.3 million. With this money coming in, he wanted to finally realise his greatest dream. He wanted to create a music room in their home, in the unfinished servant quarters that sat above the garage. Apparently the room that he already had in this house with his instruments in wasn't enough. He wanted a perfect music room. Soundproofed, acoustically perfect, with a high fidelity system built into the walls with the best instruments. He wanted it to be a place for him to practice, but also a place that he could put on performances for his friends. It was going to cost around $10,000, he said, but John constantly told Joan how little money they had. Even though by this point he had increased her monthly allowance to $700, that was barely enough to cover the running cost of this huge house they now lived in, and every time Joan asked for more money, he would tell her there wasn't any. Whether there actually was or wasn't more money, I'm not too sure. But John was earning more money at his practice than he ever had done before, but he also enjoyed spending money. He wanted to borrow the $10,000 off of Ash for the music room, who of course refused because he just loaned him $12,000 for house deposit. Of course, this $10,000 was akin to more $80,000 nowadays. It was a lot of money that John was asking for. So instead, John has to take out a bank loan. But the $10,000 was barely enough to even scratch the surface of what John wanted in his music room. He wanted it to be perfect. He was a man obsessed with the idea of this perfect music room. $10,000 didn't even cover the cost of the carpets that he wanted. It was that summer of 1968 that their marriage really began to fall apart. And the beginning can be specifically pinpointed to a summer camp that they'd sent Boot to. Boo had been at Camp Rio Vista for 4 weeks and was due to be picked up in the August. John couldn't be bothered to go to pick him up, but Joan refused to go alone. It wasn't just a case of opening the car door and Boo jumping in. They had to go and spend the day there, see what the kids had been up to over the past few weeks, and just sort of see the camp. So John had to cancel everything and go with his wife to pick up their son. It wasn't all bad for John though, because once they arrived, he quickly met a woman called Anne Kurth, whose child was also at the camp. Anne had been married 3 times, now divorced from each, with 3 sons, and apparently was a very attractive woman. John spent the entire day taking photos at the camp, and by the time they returned home, he had numerous photos of Anne in his camera roll. An excellent excuse to call her up later in the week and organise a meeting to look through the photos. And so an affair begins. Anne later said that John told her that his marriage was all but over, that he was trapped and his life was meaningless. He was so unhappy. Apparently, all Joan cared about was her horses, and all he cared about was music and medicine. And to be fair to him, it does seem like he made an attempt to leave Joan once the affair was underway. One day, Joan arrived home after a horse show to find a note left for her reading, "Things are not good between us. I've gone away for a few days." Despite trying to get in contact with John after this, she couldn't, and she was devastated that her husband would walk out on her. Despite everything, it does seem like she did really love him. For the next 2 weeks, she wouldn't sleep or eat until eventually John called. He wanted to talk things over with Joan and they agreed to meet at the house. But if they thought that this would be a happy reunion, it was not. It went badly very quickly and John soon left. But it was noted by one of Joan's friends who was keeping an eye that John hadn't turned up at the house alone. There was another car that pulled up alongside him outside the house. So after John leaves, Joan and her friend decide to follow. It wasn't long until Joan saw him with Anne Kurth. So Joan literally approaches him on the street to ask him if this was the woman he was having an affair with. In a very strange twist, John denies everything, but actually says that he was having an affair with Anne's husband and that she was blackmailing him. There's a lot to unpack there and I'm not quite sure where to begin with that. Did John think it would be less painful for Joan if he was having an affair with a man instead of a woman? Or did he think it would be more embarrassing for her and he just wanted to hurt her? Did he think this could be a good way of getting Ash to give him more money if they thought he was being blackmailed and it would save their reputation of him being a homosexual man? I don't know, I would love to know the thought process here. Of course though, it was Anne that John was having an affair with and not her husband. Joan hired an off-duty policeman to snoop on John and discover as much. Joan wanted John to come home, but he wasn't interested at all, with Anne on one occasion saying to Joan that she'd actually encouraged John to go home and talk out with her, see his son, but John just wasn't interested. He was sick of his life with Joan, he was sick of being controlled by Ash, sick of always being second best. He was not shy about parading his new woman Anne about town. He didn't try and hide the affair at all after the whole husband affair blackmail thing. But despite parading Anne around town, he was actually continuing to work on his music room back at Kirby Drive where he lived with Joan. In total, it cost him more than $75,000, over $600,000 today. For some reason, it seems that he thought that even if him and Joan divorced, he would somehow definitely take ownership of the house, even though the deposit had been paid for by Joan's father. John was intending on a divorce. In November 1968, Joan got handed divorce papers. And despite friends telling her that this was for the best, John was not her match, Joan was incredibly upset. Whether she really loved John or just didn't want to divorce for a third time isn't entirely clear, but to me it seems like she definitely had more feelings for him than he did for her. And Ash Robinson, despite clearly hating John, was also not happy about what was going on. He gives John a call at the bachelor pad he was currently living in and says some things I guess can only equate to actual blackmail. Curiously, Joan would soon receive a letter at her house written by Ash and signed by John. It begins, "Mrs. Joan Hill, I ask that you become reconciled with me and forgive my transgressions. I want to come back home and be a good husband to you and be a good father to Robert. In the event of any additional separation between us, no matter what the cause or reason, I will deed you all of my interest in our home at 1561 Kirby Drive." It goes on to say that he would continue to make payments on the house until it's paid for, that he would pay for all the upkeep and would give her $1,000 per month and place $7,000 in her account at once. Now, John was clearly coerced into signing this letter. It was written by Ash, and we don't know exactly what would have been said in that conversation between him and Ash that made him sign it. I personally think that Ash probably pushed John to realise that in the event of a divorce, he would lose his precious music room, but there was probably a bit more to it than that, but we'll never know. And so John returns home to Joan, but he does continue his relationship with Anne, just keeping it a little bit more under wraps. He would pretend that he was getting calls from the hospital, then drive to Anne's house, but Joan wasn't stupid. She eventually cottoned on to exactly what was happening. But she had other things holding her attention, as Chatsworth Farm wasn't doing too great at this point. The breeding programme had never really taken off, and that's where the money was supposed to be. Ash was threatening to close it down, so Joan was trying to troubleshoot. She invited two friends over to the house for a couple of days to help her come up with ideas on how to fix the farm, Diane and Eunice. They arrived on 9th of March 1969 for a very strange couple of days. It was clear to the house guests that John and Joan were not in a happy marriage. Joan immediately started complaining about her husband as soon as they arrived, and John wasn't home from work long when he got called back to the hospital. He seemed to be always back and forth. But on his return home, he bought pastries. He seemed to be in a really fantastic mood. He presented pastries to all of the women, handing them each individual pastries on plates. When Joan remarked that she'd actually prefer a cream puff to the chocolate eclair though, John told her that he'd picked out hers especially because she liked chocolate. That was in the afternoon, and in the evening he did the same thing, handed them each a specific pastry on a plate. Joan received another chocolate eclair, and John refused to trade for his cream puff once again. And then they all went to bed. The next day was like most, except Joan didn't seem to be her usual happy self. John said he'd be home for dinner that evening, but he didn't arrive in time, instead turning up later with yet more pastries instead. The day after that, the Saturday, Joan didn't get out of bed until nearly 4 p.m, which was incredibly late for her, as she was embarrassed that she'd slept all day, leaving her house guests to fend for themselves. It turns out that John had given her a sleeping pill the night before, and it completely knocked her out, or so she said. That day, John took Boot out for a haircut, for which they were gone for almost 2 hours. When Joan asked Boot what had taken such a long time, he said that Daddy had made him promise not to tell. It turns out they'd gone to the apartment where John had lived in the time they'd broken up, the apartment that Joan thought John had sold long before. Upset, Joan called her good friend Van over to the house to talk. She prepared drinks for all of her guests, Van, Diane and Eunice, and they go to the music room to talk, where John was also listening to his music. The women played a game of bridge, and Joan kept speaking very ill of John, making sure that he could hear. She said, "I'm going to the lawyer on Monday. It's just about over between us." It was all very dramatic, and I can't help but feel for the guests, who must have felt so awkward. But then Joan and John begin dancing together randomly before John leads her upstairs to bed. He told their guests that Joan didn't feel too well. She spent the entire next day, the Sunday, in bed and couldn't keep down any food or drink at all. John went to the drugstore to get medication for her, but she couldn't even keep that down. Joan didn't know if it was a virus or food poisoning, all she knew was that she felt horrific. On the Monday morning, Eunice and Diane left Dallas. They noted that John was on his way to work as they left, and he said that their maid, Effie, was going to look after Joan for the day, but he was going to stop at the drugstore and order her some more medication. Effie was given instructions to let Joan rest and not disturb her. But despite this order, Effie felt compelled to check in on her by mid-afternoon and found Joan in a terrible way, telling Effie that she was so sick. Effie said that Dr. Hill would be home soon to check on her, but she was very worried. Eventually, John did arrive home, and Effie assumed that he was caring for Joan until the next morning, when he summoned her back upstairs, where Joan was found lying limp and unresponsive. John ordered Effie to clean up Joan's mess and make sure that she was taking her medicine. But when she went to clean up, Effie realised that Joan had been laying in her own faeces for hours. At some point, John had just shoved 2 white towels underneath her and just left the towels to collect Joan's bodily waste. She was so ill she couldn't even get up to go to the toilet. And her nightgown hadn't been changed since Effie had last tended to her the previous day. Joan was hot and cold, she wasn't able to control her bowels, her face was beginning to turn blue. So Effie did the only thing she knew how to do. She prayed and then tried to call Joan's parents, except they weren't home. Instead, she calls John's office to be told that he's not there. She said to the secretary that John better be back soon because Joan was terrible sick and he better put her in the hospital. Of course, John wasn't in the office because he was doing a musical performance playing tuba at a local elementary school. Rhea Robinson, Joan's mother, went round to visit her daughter that morning, and she knew that she was ill but had no idea how seriously ill Joan was until she arrived, finding John making arrangements for her to go to Sharpstown Hospital. Now, Sharpstown was a very strange choice of hospital, especially for a doctor such as John Hill. It was a small, new and unknown hospital in the city, about half an hour away from their home. It was much further away than the Texas Medical Center, which was one of the world's greatest hospitals. John said that she would receive special care at Sharpstown and drove her there himself, apparently driving the entire way at a snail's pace. When they arrived, Joan got rushed into hospital, but Rhea later discovered that this hospital had no emergency room and no intensive care unit whatsoever. It was just a modest suburban hospital. It didn't have any of the facilities that the Texas Medical Center did. Joan was treated by Dr. Bertinot, who upon discovery of a dangerously low blood pressure ordered IV fluids. From the symptoms she was suffering, he thought that she might have some kind of dysentery or salmonella or food poisoning. Despite being so ill, Joan was still very polite and rational. She greeted the doctor by his name. He was baffled as to what was going on. Nothing he did made her any better and she just seemed to get worse. He thought that she might have septic shock, but then she stopped passing urine, indicating kidney failure. After 8 p.m. that night, it became clear that she was in serious kidney failure and they needed facilities that were unavailable to them at the hospital. But by this point, she was too sick to move. They needed to do peritoneal dialysis, but needed John's permission as her next of kin to do so. Except he was nowhere to be seen. He'd returned home, leaving Joan lying sick in hospital and was just in his music room. Effie answered a phone call from the hospital not long after 9 p.m. and John didn't arrive back there until 11 p.m. and it was only a half an hour drive. Surely he should have left immediately. Once he arrived, he casually sat at her bedside whilst Joan fought for her life. By 2:30 a.m, Joan had sudden heart failure. She hemorrhaged and then, just like that, she was dead, aged just 38. Now, the law in the state of Texas is that an autopsy must be performed by the county coroner on anyone who dies in hospital within 24 hours of admission. The coroner must rule on a cause of death before the body can be released for embalming and burial. But weirdly, this is not what happened in the case of Joan Robinson Hill. Almost immediately after she died, John asked a friend to call a local funeral home, the Setacast Cop Funeral Home, to remove Joan's body. They arrived and removed the body within just 4 hours of her death. Whilst John was doing this, Dr. Bertinot was calling the hospital's pathologist called Dr. Morse to make plans for the autopsy. Now, the hospital didn't even have the facilities for a post-mortem, so it's assumed that she was going to have the autopsy done at the funeral home. But either as a result of bad communication or perhaps not so bad communication, depending on who's asking, the embalmer started to work on Joan's body before the pathologist ever arrived. Joan's blood was drained and replaced with embalming fluid. And once a body's been embalmed, an autopsy is all but useless. But Dr. Morse fought on regardless, doing what he could. He noted that Joan was an attractive, well-nourished woman. When he sliced it open, he could see nothing that caused any question on any of her organs. There was no damage or any tumours. The only thing that caused him concern was her pancreas, which was described as soft, red and mushy. Perhaps she died of pancreatitis. But that was about all he could do given the circumstances. When Dr. Morse first got the call about Joan's death, he didn't exactly rush. And when he arrived at the funeral home and found the body already embalmed, he just kind of assumed that she'd been in hospital for longer than 24 hours and therefore there was nothing illegal about the situation. It was all just a case of miscommunication here as far as he was concerned. He didn't think to raise this any further. When he took the samples that he'd taken from Joan's body back to his lab, he still found no clear-cut cause of death. He could tell that there'd been some inflammation that spread throughout the body but couldn't find its source, and without blood there would be no way of knowing, so he kind of just settled on pancreatitis once and for all. Joan Robinson Hill was buried on Friday the 21st of March 1969. A huge funeral with floral arrangements sent in from across America, people wanting to pay their respects. But that very morning, Ash Robinson had actually made a visit to the Assistant District Attorney's office, stating that he believed John Hill would be responsible for his daughter's death. He thought the entire situation surrounding her death and consequent autopsy were very strange, and the Assistant DA just listened. The Assistant DA called the Harris County Medical Examiner and told him to go to the funeral home before the funeral and stop the service if he needed to. Joan wasn't to be buried without further answers. The medical examiner called around and heard of the circumstances surrounding the strange first autopsy and ordered Dr. Morse to hand over the specimens from this first autopsy. The funeral just went ahead as planned that day. He thought he had enough information in the form of the report and the first specimens. And this report on the second autopsy was delivered by the end of the month. saying, "It is my opinion, based upon a reasonable probability, that the cause of death is due to acute focal hepatitis, probably viral in origin. It was not poison, and the assistant DA said there was no further case to look into. Joan could have caught hepatitis in the days before her death. She was eating shellfish and snails. It could have been anything." But of course, Ash wasn't going to accept defeat that easily. He thought Joan had been murdered. So he starts petitioning for John to give permission to exhume Joan's body for yet another autopsy. With John being next of kin, it was his decision. And of course, John refused, but Ash continued looking for the best pathologist in the country to perform this autopsy that he was going to get. 3 months after Joan's death, knowing the suspicion that was on him and the rumours that Ash was spreading around town, John decides to put himself forward for a polygraph test, a lie detector. He didn't want to take the standard test though. He was very specific. They wanted to opt for a truth serum, sodium pentothal, and the test was to take place in a hospital, not a police station. The hospital in question was, of course, Sharpstown. The DA agreed to his conditions, and very strangely, John answered some very simple questions surrounding Joan's death wrong. He got her time of death off by almost an hour, and said that she first got ill on the Friday, when in fact she was very much alive and healthy on the Friday. Under the sodium pentothal, John went on this long ramble about the days prior to Joan's death, which was unusual, as answers given under truth serum are usually quite short and terse, although not always. But all of this sounded pretty rehearsed according to people who heard it. What stuck out most to me about this test is that when he was asked what instructions he left with the servant Effie when he left the house on the Monday, he said that he told Effie to look after Joan and take care of her. He didn't. He told Effie to leave Joan alone to rest. He was also outright asked if he'd caused Joan at any point to ingest something that could have caused illness. John said no. But despite these questions he got wrong, that he should have got right, these very simple questions, John passed the lie detector test with flying colours. But let's turn our attention back to Ash, who at this point was in the process of getting hold of the best pathologist in the world. Whilst he knew that really only the next of kin, John, could order another exhumation and another autopsy, he also knew that a court could order it as well. Essentially, Ash annoyed the district attorney until he agreed to put the matter to a grand jury, who in the end voted to let another exhumation happen, or let an exhumation happen. True to his word, Ash did hire the best pathologist, a Dr. Milton Hilpern, who flew in from New York to conduct yet another autopsy. This took place on the 11th of August 1969, but upon opening the coffin, Dr. Hilpern noticed something. There was old, dried mud inside the casket. The only explanation was that Joan had already been dug up once before. Her coffin had already been opened. Upon a bit of investigation, it was discovered that just 3 days after the funeral, Joan had indeed been exhumed at the order of John. Apparently, he opened the coffin because he thought Joan had been buried with a ring that he wanted back. At this first exhumation, John apparently wasn't with the body for more than a few minutes and he was supervised the entire time, so there wasn't any time to tamper with her body, but this is just very strange. He told Ash that he wouldn't give permission to exhume Joan because he didn't want to disturb her, but clearly John didn't care about that because he'd already disturbed her for something as small as a ring. But that wasn't the strangest thing about this autopsy. Dr. Hilpern actually discovered that Joan's brain and heart were both missing. It turns out that Dr. Morse had removed both during his first autopsy, something that wasn't made known to Hilpern beforehand, it wasn't in the notes. Whilst it was unusual, the removal of both organs is something that was done occasionally, the weird thing was just that there wasn't really any notes about it. Almost a year after Joan's death, the result of this third autopsy came in, saying that she came to her death as a result of a fulminating infectious process, the specific nature of which is no longer determinable. It was recommended that the matter be investigated by a grand jury. It was also noted that John's home treatment of his wife, or lack thereof, and the delay in seeking medical attention at hospital were key factors in her death. Had he taken her to hospital sooner, she likely would have lived. John Hill was not looking great in light of all this. It also didn't help that he'd married Anne Kurth in the June, just 3 months after Joan's death. And John and Anne's marriage was not a happy one, him later describing marrying her as the biggest mistake of his life.
There seemed to be violence on both ends, lots of jealousy on Anne's behalf, or Joan, and Anne and John had only been together for 10 months when they married. Anne had no idea about the level of debt that John was in, and she had no idea just how obsessive he was about his music. Plus, by this point, John was in the eyes of all of Houston's law enforcement. He was looking more suspicious by the moment in Joan's death. Just 4 months after they married, John tried to file for divorce, but his attorney hesitated because it was looking likely that he was about to be indicted for murder, and if he was still married to Anne, she couldn't testify against him. If she divorced him, John's attorney said that she would join forces with Ash Robinson and destroy him, but he divorced her anyway. The whole legal proceedings around this were very confusing, so just to straighten out the timeline a little bit here. So as we know, Ash petitioned with the DA to launch a murder investigation. The DA wasn't convinced that John was guilty, but put the evidence in front of a grand jury anyway, who began hearing evidence in the summer of 69. It was at that point that John did the whole polygraph test thing, and the first grand jury retired without indicting him. Then the exhumation at Ash's behest happened after a second grand jury looked at the evidence and decided that there was something a little bit dodgy going on here. In February 1970, the case was heard by a third grand jury. John's divorce from Anne was finalised on March 11th, and she testified against her ex-husband in front of this grand jury on March 12th. She said that John had confessed to her that he'd killed Joan and that he tried to kill her 3 times as well. She also said that the truth serum test that John did was rigged, that he'd given himself the antidote before it took place. She said that John Hill was a violent man. At this third grand jury trial, Halpern's autopsy findings were officially presented and John appeared himself. They questioned him on the stand about the pastries and the arguments that the couple had over money. If you want a really in-depth description of what went on at this trial and the following trials, I would highly recommend reading Blood and Money. This video is already incredibly long, I'm sure, without me detailing every question, but this trial is so interesting. But despite everything that was presented to the grand jury, they couldn't find enough evidence to indict John Hill for murder. They could prove that he was a shit husband, but they couldn't prove that he was a murderer. But by now, the DA was pretty convinced that he was guilty, that he had done it, and that he ought to be indicted. So the DA sets out to find proof. The assistant DAs trawl through the law books, looking for any loophole they could use to get John, till eventually they came across something called murder by omission. Now, there were perhaps 20 cases of murder by omission at this point in all of US history, and never before in Texas. Murder by omission is essentially that if you owe a duty to a person and you fail to perform it and that person ends up dying, you can be guilty of homicide. Blood and Money brings up a perfect example of this. If you're driving across a bridge and you see somebody preparing to leap, you don't have any obligation to stop and help this random person. But if you're driving across the bridge and your wife jumps out of the car to jump, then you have a responsibility to pull over and help her. If you just let it happen and continue driving, that's murder by omission. So John not taking Joan to hospital in a timely manner, murder by omission. So now they had to get together another grand jury to prove this charge. Finally, a grand jury voted 10-2 in favour of indictment. This meant that a full trial was to happen, where he was to be tried for the murder of his wife, by omission of course. And John was bothered by this of course, but he wasn't too bothered, because by this point he'd already met another woman who vowed to stand by him. Her name was Connie Loseby. Connie was very, very unlike Joan and Anne in that she was kind of the antithesis of them. She was exactly what John wanted and needed. Connie loved music, she had a master's degree in the subject, and she was just kind of perfect for him. It wasn't long until the two were engaged. But before a wedding, there was a murder trial, which began on 15th of February 1971. And once again, Anne testified against John, and claimed that he tried to kill her by crashing their car into a bridge, and then on another occasion by injecting her with a hypodermic needle. She once again said that he'd confessed to killing Joan and that she'd seen 3 petri dishes in the bathroom of his apartment, the one that he'd hidden from Joan. And she'd seen this in the time that Joan was ill. He told her at the time that he was simply conducting an experiment, but in hindsight, it's a bit weird. She also says that she saw pastries in the fridge and he told Anne specifically not to eat them. Apparently, he eventually confessed to her that the petri dishes contained cultures grown from human waste and that he'd injected them into the pastries, as we probably all expected by this point in the video. And whilst this does sound like scathing testimony, it actually ended up resulting in a mistrial. See, Texas law stated that a wife could not testify against her husband concerning confidential communications that took place during their marriage, even an ex-wife. Anne couldn't talk about anything on the stand that John had told her in confidence whilst they were still married. And this was going to make things complicated. But the assistant DA found another small loophole in which a wife could testify about things that happened during the marriage if it happened whilst she was in danger, whilst he was beating her up or harming her in any way. Therefore, Anne could talk about the attempts made on her life and the conversations surrounding that. And it just so happens that the two had some very deep conversations whilst Anne's life was supposedly in danger. But Anne embellished on her story on the stand a lot. It was all very dramatic and essentially ended in a mistrial. Anne's word couldn't be taken and the trial was instead to be rescheduled for several months' time. As you can imagine, Ash Robinson was furious. John, on the other hand, was over the moon and ended up marrying Connie not long after in June 1971. And it does seem like this marriage was a lot happier than his previous two. They were just happy with each other and their love of music. The trial was originally reset for July 1971, but it got postponed at the request of the defence to the autumn, and then postponed again to the following summer, and then for the following November. It seemed like a second trial was just never going to happen. And it never would do. For the next year or so, John and Connie lived happily, and Boot, who is now called his birth name of Robert, was happy with Connie as a stepmom after a tumultuous couple of years. Slowly, John started to be accepted back into Houston society and people kind of just forgot about the trial, everyone except Ash. But more tragedy was yet to come. On the 24th September 1972, Connie and John returned from a trip to a medical conference in Las Vegas. About an hour before they were due to arrive back home, a masked intruder forced his way into their house when 12-year-old Robert answered the front door, who was being looked after by his paternal grandmother. The intruder bound both of them and covered their mouths. When Connie and John arrived home and rang the doorbell, they expected Robert to answer, only to be greeted by a man in a green mask. The man grabbed Connie and said, "This is a robbery," but she managed to escape and run down the street for help. As she ran, she heard shots being fired. When the police and ambulance arrived at the home, they found Robert standing over his father, who'd been shot dead in the hallway. Robert had managed to hop from the back room, still bound to his father, and he was crying, "They've killed my daddy." John had been shot 3 times in the chest, shoulder, and right arm, and it was not an accident. If you've been paying any attention at all, then you'll know who the main suspect was here. It was Ash Robinson, who just wanted vindication for his beloved daughter's death. But it wasn't quite that straightforward, and it was clear very early on that Ash wasn't the gunman himself. I mean, Robert would have recognised him. And Ash insisted that he'd rather get justice through John being alive than dead. John being dead benefited Ash's cause in no way whatsoever. It was discovered that John had been shot with a 38 caliber pistol and the perpetrator took his wallet and quickly fled the scene. The gun was later found at the scene below a bush and a ballistics expert was able to discover that the bullets used were actually handmade. All in all, it was very easy to trace this gun back to its owner, a doctor called Dr. Orrin Staves. It was purchased in Longview, Texas in 1969. Oh, but that would be too easy. It turns out that the gun had been stolen from Dr. Staves by a sex worker by the name of Dusty, an obvious alias, in February or March of that same year. Luckily though, he thought he knew her real name, Marcia McKittrick. So now they had to track down Marcia. After some digging, they found out that she worked for a pimp called Cleet. But Cleet had been in prison, so now Marcia was working elsewhere. 6 months passed with nothing except for a whisper that she was now working for a man called Bobby, who they eventually found out was called Bobby Vandiver, a habitual criminal and pimp. He was eventually arrested by the police in April 1973, but refused to cooperate until John's mother came in and identified him as a man that had tied her up that day. Only then does Bobby crack and say that he was in fact guilty, but Marsha and a woman called Lilla Paulus were also involved. He said that for a long time there had been rumours circulating that there was an opportunity of a contract killing, to kill a man for quite a bit of money. Lots of people had turned it down and Bobby at first was not interested. Plus it was only $5,000, which isn't much for an assassination. But Bobby was skint and needed money quickly. He eventually relented and decided to do it. It was Lilla Paulus who was his contact for the crime, and Marsha was the one who pushed him to do it and helped him pull it off. Marsha was his getaway driver after the crime took place. In April 1973, a grand jury voted to indict Bobby and Marsha for first degree murder and Lilla as an accomplice to murder. The trial was meant to take place in September but was postponed to April 1974, except Bobby didn't turn up for the trial. He's gone on the run to Longview, Texas. When a police officer in Longview eventually figured out who he was, he confronted him and ended up shooting Bobby dead. So now Joan's dead, John's dead, Bobby's dead. It was several more months till Marsha was caught, but she was eventually arrested in September 1973, and she corroborated Bobby's whole story in questioning. But she said one very important thing, that she knew who had contracted the murder in the first place. She said she had met Ash Robinson at Lilla Paulus' house, and she knew the two had met frequently at Ben Torp Hospital, which is where the money was apparently handed over. She was eventually convicted of being Bobby's getaway driver and was given a 10-year sentence, paroled after 5 years. Lilla Paulus' trial took place in February 1975. At the trial, Marsha testified that Ash Robinson had paid Lilla $25,000 to find somebody to carry out the murder, and in turn, Lilla paid Bobby $5,000 of that. But both Marsha and Ash, who obviously denied all these claims, passed polygraph tests. Once again, I could go into the trial in detail, but it doesn't seem too necessary. It was all pretty messy. But the main points are that Ash had apparently taken out a private telephone number at some point, which was then found written on a scrap paper in Lilla's handbag. It was also found that Diane Settegast, the same woman who'd been staying with Joan the weekend she got ill, knew Lilla Paulus and had introduced her to Joan in the early 60s. Diane was accused of being the one to tell Lilla that Ash Robinson wanted somebody to kill John, that she was the one who introduced the two. But Diane said that she'd only seen Lilla and Ash together once before at Chatsworth Farm the year before Joan died. Essentially, it was all just very messy. Ash claimed that he had nothing to do with the murder. He didn't deny knowing Lilla, but said that she simply loved Joan, as did everyone, and that she did what she did to avenge Joan's death without any communication from him. He said he was innocent and had nothing to do with it. Lilla had acted off her own back. Lilla was convicted and given a 35-year sentence, but eventually this was overruled on the basis that there wasn't enough evidence to prove guilt, and then she was released. But then that was overruled and the original conviction and sentencing was reinstated. Lilla ended up dying in prison in the 80s. So, all in all, this case was an absolute shit show from beginning to end. Did John Hill kill Joan, or did she really just get ill? Did Ash pay for a hit on John because he was sick of the waiting around? Did he just want revenge? Was the whole thing just one huge misunderstanding? Honestly, who knows? I'm inclined to think that John did poison Joan, but then again, a huge basis of the claims against him was said by his very bitter and very angry ex-wife Anne. The petri dishes to me speak volumes, but did they even exist? Did Anne make it up? I have no idea in this case, and I'm sure the comment section is going to be very interesting here, and I can't wait to see what you guys think on this one. In the end, Connie got custody of Robert and raised him herself, eventually remarrying. The two of them ended up suing Ash in a wrongful death action for the murder of John for $7.6 million, but Ash always proclaimed his innocence. The Robinsons ended up leaving Houston for Pensacola, Florida, and years later they did reconcile with their grandson Robert. Robert grew up to also ride horses, clearly getting his talents from his mother. Anne Kurth released a book about the case called Prescription Murder, in which she expanded on the claims she made in court, but not before moving out of Houston to the outskirts of Austin. Pretty much everyone who was once involved in this case is now dead, so we'll never get any further answers. It's destined to always be a mystery. Maybe Joan did just die from an unexplained infection and all of this was for nothing. She just had a shitty marriage and a shitty husband, but he didn't kill her.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.